Welcome back to the Extension Experience Podcast. I'm Dana Zook. This morning, Dr. Barry Whitworth is joining me to discuss this little issue we have called the New World Screwworm. Dr. Whitworth is the Extension Area Food and Animal Quality Health Specialist. He is our licensed veterinarian and a resource for all county extension educators across the state, so we do appreciate him. And so welcome, Barry.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I just flipped over my calendar. I'm the old-fashioned calendar lady, Barry. It feels like summer today. We're recording June 2nd, and summer means external parasites in the livestock industry. And so an sort of unfamiliar external parasite has been dominating the headlines lately, and it's unfamiliar to us. The New World Screwworm. I don't know. We'll just call it a screwworm. Is that all right, Barry?
That sounds good to me.
We don't need any tongue twisters on a Monday morning. No. So it's been dominating the news. We really haven't experienced this parasite in a long time. Why don't we set the stage, Barry? Why don't you tell us just a little bit about the New World Screwworm, kind of the biology of that? We'll just jump into that first, and then we'll give people a timeline of what has happened over the last 6 months or so.
Sure. When you hear about screwworms, even when I was in practice, when I started in 1990, screwworms had been eradicated from the United States for several years when I began my career as a veterinarian. Still, people would on occasion say, you know, bring me a cow or a sheep or a goat. It's got screwworms. And I was like, no, it's got maggots. It doesn't have screwworms. Okay. You've got an injury here, something happened, or, you know, we've done something here. You've got necrotic tissue, and these maggots are feeding on dead tissue. So the difference between, you know, screwworm and maggots is they feed on live tissue. That's the big thing about them. The female fly will find a wound or something like that on a cow, a tick bite even, or if we do some type of procedure like castration or dehorning or something, they find that wound, they lay their eggs on it or very near it. Eggs hatch fairly quickly. And they have that, the screwworm comes from their appearance. They just screw down into that tissue and start to feed on that live tissue for a few days. Then they'll fall out, burrow into the soil forest pupae, and hatch in a few days. And we can start the whole cycle over again. But the big deal is they feed on flesh, live tissue.
And how often do you have maggots in dead tissue on a living animal? I mean, is that very common?
No,
I wouldn't
really
think so.
Not.
Okay.
You'll just see it every now and then when I was in practice.
Okay. All right. That's kind of why it has caused such an uproar, because we had gotten rid of it in the United States, and we'll talk about that here in a minute. And so here's kind of the timeline of what has happened and why this has come to light. So initially, the first case of the New World Screwworm was reported in Mexico in November, and the border was temporarily shut down. Correct, Barry?
That is correct. Right? I've kind of followed this for a few years, but if you go back and look, like in 2023 and previous years, Panama was probably having about, they'd have about 25 cases a year. And then all of a sudden, it went to like 6,000 cases, and, you know, and then it's even higher than that. And then it started showing up in Nicaragua, Costa Rica started having this enormous increases in cases. So it shouldn't have been a big surprise that in November of 2024 that we found a case in Mexico, because we knew it was bouncing around down in Central America and the cases were increasing. That was the big deal. You're starting to see increased numbers of cases. And then, of course, in November, they found the first cases in Mexico. Like you said, shut the border down. Then they reopened it in February. They went through a process. I mean, they did just arbitrarily say, oh, let's reopen it. Went through a process of what they were going to do as far as what restrictions and specifications they had to meet to cross the border from Mexico into the United States. And then again in May, Secretary Rawlins closed it again. And I think that's just because of the increased number of cases that continue to occur in Mexico.
Yeah, so concerned because it's moving north in Mexico, and they have pretty strict procedures at the border to go through everything, but it just was concerning enough that they shut it down again. So.
Because you think that how is it going to get into the United States? Well, it's probably an animal brings it into the United States. It would be a very, I wouldn't say a common, but it'd be a good way that it could get here. And actually, the flies could actually just continue to migrate northward and just get here because of that northward migration. The other thing you have to watch out is weather events. We do know that the flies have been dispersed in different locations or movement because of weather events. So,
I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
that can happen.
How far does a fly fly when it's
That's
being
right.
flown at 70 miles an hour in a storm? Wow.
Exactly. Yeah, so they can be displaced due to weather events and show up in locations you wouldn't expect. Or
Okay.
make a quick, I would say maybe they make a quicker migration than you would expect.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. I didn't even think about that. So we talked about where it is in Mexico, like you said, the Caribbean. So it is present in Cuba, Jamaica. And so we see it there. And as far as the species that it affects, Barry, speak to that because I have had some questions about that.
Yeah, it's any warm-blooded animal we could find it. Obviously, you think, I think as far as agriculture is concerned, we think more of our cattle, sheep, and goats, maybe a horse occasionally, but you think cattle, sheep, and goats is probably the big ones. And it in the wildlife, you don't forget about the wildlife. You know, I've heard it, I've heard some of the older veterinarians and those people that dealt with it before talk about like white-tailed deer. There's nothing that was more beneficial to white-tailed deer populations than the eradication of screwworm. You know, it saved a lot of baby fawns from dying.
So, as you say that, I mean, it is really hard on young livestock. So, older, mature livestock can tolerate it in a way, but.
And it's the navels, the open wound again. Newborns
Okay.
have the navel, and that's where they will infect.
Okay.
I've heard nothing costs more cowboys their jobs than the eradication of screwworms, because when you go back to the past, even it hadn't been that many. A few months ago, I went to Chickasha and spoke to a group of cattlemen, and one of the cattle producers said, "When I was a kid, Dad got me a horse, and I got up every morning and rode and looked for newborn calves and treated every navel we had for screwworm, prevent the flies from getting on that wound and laying their eggs." So,
That is such a good point, Barry. I'd
yeah.
not even thought about that. Very interesting. That speaks to just the prevalence of the impact it could have. So it could get into wildlife. We don't necessarily have a control on wildlife. It's,
No.
every young livestock animal, it could affect that. So it just speaks to the wider impact that it could have and why this is so serious. And so I think that that's important to understand.
I think about like my great uncle who had, wasn't a big cattle producer, but he had about 150 cows, and this would go way back. And I talk, and I and when you discuss with him back then, they talked about they got all their procedures done early in the spring. You had to get if castrations, dehorns, that did all that early in the spring because you couldn't wait till get very far into the summer, or you would have to be worried about screwworm problems. So it all. Or you had to wait until after frost, the first frost in the fall, then you could start working your cattle again. So,
Into historical perspective. Never would have known that. I don't consider myself an extremely young person, but oh my goodness. So, Barry, tell us about some of the controls that they have implemented in the last 4 decades in Central America to help control the spread.
Obviously, we had insecticides is how we had to control it, prevent it, control it, whatever you want it, word you want to use, that ranchers and farmers used when they did any type of procedures, or like I said, when they treated the navels and newborns. That's what we did. But in the early 50s, they developed a technique, and it was originally developed in fruit production. They call it the sterile insect technique, where they figured out they could take these male flies, raise them a day around day 6 or 7. They would put them into a chamber and use radiation. They zapped them, so to speak. And then those males are then sterile. Again, it was originally in fruit flies. Then they got, well, maybe this would work for screw worm. And so they did it. And what you get out of that is you get a male that was sterile. And it also goes along with the biology of the species, because typically females only mate once. So if we throw enough sterile males out there, they mate with the females, then these eggs are not viable. When she lays her eggs, they're not going to hatch. So they built facilities. I think originally built a facility in Florida. Then I'm not sure if the other facility was in Texas or where, but they built facilities in the United States. Basically eradicated the fly from the United States. Then they went to Mexico and built a facility and continued to progress down south. And they have now currently the what they call the COPEG facility, COPEG, is in Panama. It's a joint venture with the United States and Panama. And they have produced these sterile flies for many years there. And they were released between Panama and Colombia in what I think they call the Darien Gap. And that was to keep these flies from migrating up from South America. And pretty well had the species eradicated from Panama all the way north, except, as you mentioned, some of the Caribbean countries and stuff they didn't. But pretty much all the Central America and Mexico into the United States, we eradicated the species. I think the last known actual documented case in Oklahoma was in 1976, they said, was the last documented case. So, and except for sporadic cases that were actually brought into the United States, either on people or an animal, that visited a country that had it, we didn't have any problems until 2016, when we had a case in the Florida Keys with the key deer, but ramped up production of the sterile flies and released them all over Florida and the Florida Keys, and that outbreak was stopped in 2017.
What a success story.
Yes. I mean, there is no telling if we added up the number of, I've seen different figures and they're all variable, but there's no telling how many, probably billions of dollars that this program has saved cattle producers in the United States.
And we don't even, I mean, now we don't even think about it, but
Exactly.
until now,
Exactly.
right?
Until
Up until
now,
now. Yeah,
right.
sorry.
Yeah, we never worried about it.
So interesting. And you were able to visit that facility on the Ag Leadership trip that you took
Yes.
to Panama, right?
Right. It's a very interesting facility. If you'd like to go and see maggots, it's really cool. Our tour started in where they mix their feed up, and they talked about all the ingredients. There's blood meal in it. There's different milk products, all that they feed, and they've got these huge cages with all these flies flying around, and they've got this material on the floor of this where they lay their eggs and they slide those eggs out. They incubate them, grow them. And then you get to see all the pupils there, and then when they run those pupils through the irradiation, they hatch and they're sterile. And they have to do it all, it's all time, because you can only do it at certain times where it's going to be effective. So it was really, and the people that work there were excited about what they do. I mean, they really were, I thought, very informative, and just were enthusiastic about what they did. So,
Well, it makes such an impact.
yes.
I mean, you're not just working with flies.
Right.
You really are doing good work for
Right.
the world's livestock industry and people. It can affect people
Right.
if you have that issue. So that's really cool. There was footage. I will say there's footage on SUNUP, an old SUNUP episode. Barry, you did look very interested. You said maybe not everybody was as interested as you were,
No,
but
No, I was probably out of the group. I was probably the one most fascinated with the facilities.
Yeah. I
So,
mean, it would be an interesting job to go to work and be around all those flies all day. I mean, my son has an insect zoo in our backyard. And so, I mean, there's some interest out there. Everybody has their own interests,
He
for sure.
probably would enjoy visiting that facility.
Yeah, I mean, that would be all little boys all about, you know, that kind of stuff. That was very, that's very interesting. I guess there, I don't think, as we talked about before we started recording, I don't think there's a cause for alarm, but I think it warrants a higher level of awareness. So that being said, what signs would producers look for in livestock?
And as we said, we don't want people to panic or anything. And I would pay attention to the news, first of all, as we talked earlier. Watch for Texas. It would be very unusual for a case to show up in Oklahoma before it shows up in Texas. That's what I would be paying attention to. Do we get a case in Texas? We get a case in Texas. That's when I would be a lot more concerned. As far as things that I would look for in the animals, in general, these are irritating. You know, you've got this maggot sitting there chewing on live tissue, so it's painful. These animals are going to be irritated about it. They may be shaking their head or, you know, something like that. There should be a smell to it. You can just imagine if these screw worm are sitting there chewing on flesh, there's going to begin to be a smell, probably going to ooze from a wound somewhere of some blood-tinged fluid, and these animals will just won't be thrifty. That's what you're going to look for. You wait too late, those wounds are going to expand quite a bit and get much bigger. These animals are going to get toxic and die from secondary bacteria because you're going to have invasion of bacteria in there. So they're going to get secondary bacterial infections and die if they're left untreated. They're probably not going to survive unless they're treated.
Right. And this comes at a time when we've got all kinds of other parasites, external
Sure.
parasites we're dealing with. And so, yeah, just being aware of the thing, I think is important. Like a lot of things in livestock, it's about management and care and understanding of health.
Exactly. I mean, in my experience when I was a veterinarian in practice, summertime producers, and I'm in general talking about cattle producers, we get caught up. There's lots of softball and baseball games go to, family events. We got to take care of our hay issues, those types of things. Cattle kind of get put on the back burner. We look at them, you know, every 2 or 3 days maybe. Don't pay as close attention to them. This is a summer. If you start hearing about cases of screw worm in Texas or something like that, probably better start paying attention to our cattle and observe them daily and look. And it's again, let's not wait and see what happens tomorrow with this. We've got one that we can tell is not right. This is probably not the year to say, well, we'll check her tomorrow and see how she's doing. Okay, let's go ahead and get her up and take a look at
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is excellent information, Barry. I guess I'll tell listeners to just stay tuned and ear to the ground and look for the news and that sort of thing will keep people informed. So, any last words, Barry, before we sign off?
Oh no, I agree with you. Just pay attention to the news. I think USDA is putting out a lot of information right now. Dr. Hall is currently put a lot of effort into trying to get information out, and they're forming a plan on what producers need to know. So that should be coming shortly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, listeners, for joining in. Thank you, Barry, for taking the time out of your busy schedule. I will have some resources in the show notes. You can also call your county extension educators if you have more questions. Barry and I are always here to answer questions if need be. But with that, we will catch you next time.